This is Ron Orle, your host, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast, where we delve into all the latest news related to activist investing and M&A. And today I'm super excited to report that I'll be speaking to Jim Rossman, Managing Director and Co-Head of Capital Markets Advisory at investment bank Lazard. Jim joined Lazard in 2003 and has over 30 years of experience as both a lawyer and investment banker. And most importantly, he and his activist defense team have worked on some of the biggest activist situations, both the US and Europe. And the deal definitely loves Lazard's quarterly 13F reports, which I immediately distribute to all the reporters on various different beats the second Jim sends it to me. So we definitely really appreciate all the crunching you guys do on the positions that activists take. And we also love Lazard's periodic review of activism. So we'll be talking about activist disclosure and new rules taking effect in August for proxy contests. Welcome, Jim. Thank you for taking the time.
All right. Well, Ron, thank you for having me on the podcast. We are religious readers of everything you and your team write about M&A and activism, and appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about these new regulatory developments.
Thank you for the kind words. Really appreciate it, Jim. So, okay, let's get right into it. The Securities Exchange Commission has been on a big disclosure push. Seems like almost every week they have some sort of new disclosure proposal. Then the one I think that is the most relevant to activists emerged just last week, where the SEC proposed changes to its 13D disclosure rule. And so basically, this is something that law firms advising companies have been pushing for a long time. And it's a rule that was kind of first implemented in 1968 and hasn't really been changed since then. And so basically, the proposal the SEC came up was to have insurgent investors, activist investors, disclose their positions faster when they cross 5% ownership threshold. So instead of having to disclose it within 10 days, which is the current situation of crossing the 5% threshold, they would have to disclose it within 5 days of crossing the threshold. And it also includes a bunch of derivatives disclosure requirements that kind of dovetail or complement another derivatives proposal that the SEC has that would really increase the disclosure of a lot of the derivatives that activists use, particularly the cash-settled equity swaps that activists use. So let's start, Jim, with the shortening of the time frame. I mean, we've been hearing for years that this is something companies have wanted, and finally they're going to get it. But, you know, I know they wanted 2 days from crossing the threshold instead of 5 days. Is this going to have an impact? Is this a positive for companies?
Yeah, Ron, this is a big win. People like myself and lawyers who advise companies on activism defense have for years been pushing for a shorter disclosure for when activists go over 5% ownership of the stock. I mean, if you think about it, companies have such limited information today about who actually owns their stock currently. 4 times a year, we get 13Fs, but that's on a 45-day delay. And 13Ds are really the best way for us to find out if an activist owns more than 5% of a company's stock. The 10-day delay has always been something we've disliked. We want to know sooner. And it's really for a couple reasons. First one is that we want to know sooner because we need to decide whether or not we're going to need to put in place, you know, defensive measures like a poison pill. And poison pills can be as low as 10% or even have thresholds at 7.5%. Some have been quite low. Most of them are 10 or 15%. But an activist during that 10-day delay for disclosing going over 5%, they could accumulate much more than 5%. They could get to 10% in some cases. And for smaller companies, they can even go well over 10%. So by knowing sooner at 5 days, we know, A, whether or not we can sort of sense, you know, based on the size of the company, whether or not there's a real threat that they're going to accumulate much more, depending on the nature of the activists and our sense of their resources. And we can also put that pill in place before the accumulation goes much higher. The second thing is that it lets the market know what's going on. The other shareholders, the traditional shareholders, are aware that there's an activist in the stock. Now, some shareholders may want to use it. It may be an incentive for them to jump in and invest in the company. And in some ways for us, that's not what the activist wants. They want to try to accumulate as much as possible at the lowest price possible. If other event-driven investors find out about it, they may want to jump in, drive up the price, and it's a disincentive for the activist to accumulate more. That's also a benefit to the company if we can try to put a cap on what they might own.
Yeah, Gary Gensler, the SEC chairman, has talked about, I guess, one of his motivations is for the rank and file mom and pop Main Street investors that they should be allowed to know earlier that an activist is accumulating. Maybe they wouldn't sell their shares to Carl Icahn or something if they'd known that he's accumulating and know that there's a big pop in the stock when he approaches. So I think that's the other part of the argument in favor of doing this.
I agree with that. It's about transparency. If you think about it, in other jurisdictions in Europe, you know, there's constant disclosure taking place. Again, we only get disclosure once every quarter for the 45-day delay. In other jurisdictions, there are thresholds which are much lower that require almost instantaneous disclosure, like if you go over 0.5% ownership or 1% or 3%. So I agree. It allows the market broadly to have more information so that everybody can participate in market moving events.
And you know, other jurisdictions also have much tougher disclosures for derivatives investments. And that's one thing that the SEC under Gensler is also trying to implement. So earlier this year, they introduced a kind of broader derivatives disclosure regime that is yet to be adopted, but they proposed it. And then this 13Ds, they have a derivatives aspect of this too that's supposed to complement the other one. But the original derivatives disclosure proposal, the 10B5 one, as it's called, they have a provision in there that would really require, you know, activists that accumulate large quantities of cash-settled equity swaps to disclose their positions. And so I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you about, Jim, is, you know, I guess, is this something that activists do a lot? I mean, I know that Elliott Management, for example, has accumulated large derivatives positions and have talked about being the second largest investor in a company where if you look at the shareholder registry, that would mean that they own over 10%, and yet they never file a 13D, which suggests that they, you know, have a large derivatives position. Yeah, you know, do you feel like that's an important addition that companies are aware that the activist is accumulating large derivatives positions? And do they have a lot of leverage on companies when they say, you know, we have a large swaps position and they can kind of pressure companies to make changes simply through owning derivatives?
Yeah, Ron, there's so many issues related to derivatives. Number one, it allows the activist to camouflage its position. And often through using stock surveillance tools, we can see that something is taking place in terms of large blocks being traded, moving in and out of certain custodian accounts, but we really were blind as company advisors. And so it allows derivatives to sort of in secret camouflage their position. And number two is options are a lot cheaper than buying the stock outright. So it allows activists to sort of accumulate very large equity positions in companies, which increases their potential influence when talking to the company. And we don't have a way to really verify it right now. And that's hard. And if you think about the amount of court resources it takes to mount an activist defense, you got to get the lawyers involved, communications people, surveillance, solicitors, bankers. It's a big machine you have to crank up. And it's almost impossible to assess whether it's we're dealing with a 1% position or 4% or even a much larger position. So in terms of who uses it, definitely Elliott is notable for its use of derivatives. But other activists use the tool too. And as activism has become more mainstream, it's, you know, it's become a big business on Wall Street for those who have trading floors to engage in these type of trading activities. You make a lot more money on options than you do selling stock regular way.
Yeah, it's always something I try to figure it out too. I look at the Nomura and the Credit Suisse 13Fs, which are huge, long documents, to see if there's some huge accumulation. Because I know that a lot of these custodian banks, they accumulate shares to, I guess, to hedge the derivatives position that they have a contract with an activist in. And so then they have to unload those shares when the activist cashes out the derivatives position, which you wonder, is it the activist then buying those shares in afterwards?
And it's led to a lot of speculation. It's worried a lot of companies. It's led to more speculation in the market. And I agree with Chairman Gensler that, you know, if you want to have efficient markets, and if derivatives are a regular approach to owning equity in a public company, why shouldn't there be disclosures around that too? That isn't just speculative investing. That is actually outright ownership through a different method. And so, listen, the companies appreciate the transparency because it allows us to make better decisions, spend, you know, more or less time on activism defense versus running the business.
Okay, there's one other aspect of the 13D rule that I thought was really interesting, but I have to say from the outset that I'm kind of wondering how effective it'll be or whether the SEC will really enforce this, which is this tipper tippy provision, which basically has the SEC proposed adjusting the 13D to expand its definition of the group for the purpose of disclosure. This is something companies are always kind of alleging, that these activists are creating this wolf pack and they all are working together, but the activists never admitted. And, you know, if they were to admit that they work together, then they would all have to combine together to file one 13D with all of their names on it. So basically, the proposal is requiring new disclosure when an investor shares non-public information about an upcoming 13D filing with another investor who subsequently buys shares. So you have like activist A crossing the 5% threshold and then calling up, you know, other funds and saying, you know, this is going to cross the wire on the 13D filing. And I guess now it'll be in 5 days, which I guess that could be an issue, but currently it's 10 days. And so other investors buy shares, whether they're activists or just, you know, merger arb type guys or whoever, but they buy shares and then they're kind of having this relationship. And so that would have to be disclosed in 13D. But how would you prove that, you know, if they were doing that and they didn't disclose it, would the SEC be able to enforce that somehow?
Yeah. Okay. So Ron, this is one of the most frustrating aspects of the market right now for companies. This is a third rail. We spend a ton of time working with our clients on disclosure and all the rules around what you can say and what you can't say. We carefully plan for our earnings calls, our investor days, conference appearances, what people can and cannot say in roadshows, non-deal roadshows. And this just feels like a huge asymmetry. If we say anything that might be viewed as omitting or disclosing something immaterial, we risk shareholder lawsuits. It feels from the company side that activists and other, what I'll call traditional investors, are allowed to talk about companies freely, share their ideas about what type of change should happen, even offer up that an activist might be willing to take action to influence or change the strategy of the company. And all of this takes place in the dark, right? Mm-hmm. And it feels like there's no barriers, there's no limits on what can be said when you know that what they're planning to do could have a significant impact on the company, its capital allocation, its strategy, its M&A. And we think it's unfair that this type of conversation can take place without those group rules sort of covering the fact that you guys are now functioning as a group and you should be subject to all the rules that have been put in place that governs group activity. You shouldn't be able to have these bilateral, off-the-record conversations and without acknowledging that you're in a group and you're effectively acting in concert to influence the strategy of the company. So I hope they enforce this. This is probably just one step they could take around the group rules, but it's an important one.
Yeah, I think I was talking to David Katz of Wachtell on my podcast last week, and he was suggesting that you would have an investor would have to fill out a form, say, have you had a conversation with another activist, and kind of to pressure them to make this disclosure or to form this group, 13D group. But I'm not really sure how that would work exactly. I guess this is something I'll have to look at the comment letters as they roll in on the 13D rule. But yeah, I have to say, I'm just skeptical that I feel like the SEC has taken efforts before to kind of try to push this 13D group, investors working as a group and should therefore disclose a 13D. But I feel like a lot of activists over the years are just communicating with each other, coming up with common goals and not disclosing it as a group in the 13D. But anyway, we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, there have been a few court rulings that talk about people acting in parallelism, but I think it's good to finally see something in writing that acknowledges that conversations take place that need to be scrutinized to see if they do rise to the level of a group.
Okay, so there's one other interesting development at the SEC, also with Gary Gensler. In a way, I mean, this was basically the universal proxy card. The SEC kind of introduced this in the outgoing Obama administration. It kind of languished for 4 years. And then Gary Gensler adopted it. And now it is something that is going to take effect in August. And I think all the advisors and activists and companies are kind of nervously awaiting this new approach to the structure for director conduct, which just very briefly for the audience who may not be aware, it essentially gives investors more flexibility to pick and choose among the incumbent and dissident slate in a contest than they currently have. So if an activist puts up four candidates and there's, let's say, eight candidates on the board, if they want to pick two of those candidates, they could still pick the other six incumbents and they wouldn't have to physically go to the meeting. Currently, you have to really do that. And prior to this rule, you have to really go to the meeting, but none of the institutional investors really go to meetings. So they're kind of left with having to pick director candidates on the distant slate, on the distant card or on the company card, and they can't really have the flexibility to pick and choose exactly what they want. And so now they will have that starting in August. So you have a very strong opinion about this, that you know, the companies put out these universal cards and it could encourage more activist investments. Can you explain that?
I've been doing this for almost a decade, Ron. This is the biggest change, one of the biggest changes I've seen that will have an impact on shareholder activism. And the reason why it's such a big change is that it essentially lowers the barrier to nominating a candidate, a dissident candidate, for a company's board. It lowers the barrier to entry. It takes the cost of doing that down to, you know, almost zero and almost some ways through the floor. Because now, if you're an activist, you would have to have your own separate card and only your candidates generally could be on that card, which meant that you were going to have dueling cards and you were going to have to spend a ton of money and effort sort of advocating for your card. And quite frankly, a lot of regular way investors, they would rather just vote for the company slate. They don't see why they should vote for one or two or three directors. They want to be able to vote for all of the directors. So if they see these two cards, they're much more sort of inclined to vote just for the company card. Now, under this new rule, the activists basically can force the company to include their candidate on the card and have a single card with all of the candidates. So it's just like going to vote on election day where you get your big card and all of the candidates are listed in one place and you don't have to go to the annual meeting to access this type of card. You can do it from your home, sitting in front of your computer. You can mix and match the candidates all the way up until the last minute when you have to finally submit your vote. And this is extraordinary. And I think it's going to result in a significant increase in shareholder activists nominating candidates for the board. And it's also going to fire some non-traditional activists also to nominate candidates. And all you have to do in order to get your candidate on the management team's, the company's card, is to say that you're going to solicit 2/3 of the shareholder vote. And that's not a high hurdle for most companies, given how concentrated the ownership is.
Someone had suggested to me that you might just be able to send a postcard with a link to a website to a few large institutions and get that 67% of shares hit.
Yeah. And also, you don't even have to mail out your own. You can mail out a competing card to the company card, but you don't even have to mail out a card. You can just say, I'm going to solicit 67% or 66%, you know, and as long as you follow the rules in the nomination for nominating a candidate, you can get your candidate on the card. And so what could a future card look like, Ron? We could have nominations from multiple activists on a card. So you got maybe the company's 10 candidates. Now you've got 2 from activist A, another 2 from activist B. If there's a climate activist, Greenpeace, someone like that who wants to sort of get a climate-friendly board member on, they can put the climate candidate on the board. If there's a union or labor issue, they can put their candidate on the board and all they have to do is send out that postcard. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, we're democratizing the ballot. It's going to be true democracy. And in terms of who it's going to directly benefit, it'll definitely directly benefit any first time or new activist who now can get on the card and their candidate be of equal positioning on the card as the company's. It's going to benefit those campaigns against, I think, small and mid-sized companies. It's also going to help those non-traditional activists like climate and labor activists. And it could also pressure companies into settling earlier. Already 90% of the activist campaigns this year involved settlements. But it's going to change that bid-ask, I think, in the settlement discussion. Activists are going to say, instead of it being companies saying, no, zero, we're not putting any of your candidates on, and the activist wants 4, a company might be more quickly pushed into saying, okay, we'll take 1 or 2, rather than having to go through all of the expense and the time associated with the proxy fight, knowing that the activist candidate is going to be listed side by side with the company candidate.
Okay, so I just want to push back on this for a second, just to be kind of a devil's advocate. I think I agree with you that this is the world we're entering, but On one level, though, for activists to be successful, the ones that are really successful, they spend a lot of money hiring proxy solicitors, just like the company hires proxy solicitors. They hire lawyers and they even hire bankers to help put them together presentations, sophisticated presentations that without which they would not have the support from the institutional investor community. So the postcard, yes, I understand the cost of actually distributing. It will be less, but to be actually really treated seriously, you have to spend a lot of money and time and energy to get people to support your candidates. Also finding the candidates. Like I heard that Engine Number One had two consulting firms they hired. They vetted like 40 or 50 potential candidates before they found the right ones. You know, that costs a lot of money. So I suspect what you're suggesting is there'll be all these kind of gadfly activists getting their director candidates on without doing a lot of the work. And it'll be a question of how successful they are. And then the traditional ones will still spend all this money, no?
Yeah, I think that's right, Ron. And I didn't mean to suggest that they wouldn't have to do the heavy lifting around finding the right candidates and making their case for change. I do agree for the gadflies, as we're calling them, we call them the climate and the labor candidates, they're not going to spend the money. What they're probably going to do is, you know, rely more on the marketing associated with who they are as gadfly. If a major environmental organization or a major pension fund says this is going to be our key issue, they're probably going to rely on that. Yeah, but for a traditional activist, they're still going to have to invest the money. They're going to have to make the case for change. Because for them, a big influence in whether or not they possibly could win the proxy fight is going to be convincing ISS and Glass Lewis, the big proxy advisors, and also convincing top 10, 20 institutional shareholders whose vote will make a difference. What's going to do, though, Ron, it's going to take out the gamesmanship and the uncertainty that's been created by having these two dueling cards. Because it's been hard on the portfolio managers and analysts at those traditional investors to sit there and say, okay, I either have to choose between these two candidates. I not only do I have to really believe in these two candidates that Disson is putting forward, I'm also giving up my right to vote for all of these other candidates that I do want to be included on the board. And I don't want to have unintended consequences of excluding them because I've chosen this card with just two directors on it. That confusion goes away and the gamesmanship. So in some ways, I think it's going to sharpen the focus on the real issues at stake. Has a case been made for change? Are these the right people to implement that change? And again, it's really empowering the portfolio managers and analysts who can sit at their desks in San Francisco or Boston and New York and have all the information on one piece of paper, which they can change, reverse themselves, go back and forth all the way up into the last minute. It's really going to be focused on the merits.
And I feel like it'll also, one of the big winners will also be the proxy advisors, the ISS and Glass Lewis, which have been always struggling with whether to tell people to vote on the Disson card or the incumbent card. Now, you know, and if they vote on the Disson card and the idea is you're more likely to support all the Disson candidates. Now maybe they can say, you know, support this one dissident and these seven incumbents, which, you know, I don't know if that could be better for the company than the current situation. I guess it depends on the situation, but
this is really a change in favor of the activists. It's an unqualified benefit to activists.
Okay. Well, it's definitely going to be interesting to see. I know already one activist has said, you know, this is coming in August. You should put in a universal card already. And the company said no. So I don't know if that's an indication of how things will play out, but this has been fantastic. So thank you, Jim, for taking the time. You've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast with Ron Orl, and we've been talking to Lazard's Jim Rossman. Thank you for taking the time, Jim.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it.